passing hour carried the Tranquility family deeper into danger. Jack believed, and convinced Ginger, that their enemies would soon move against them. The drive from Elko in the motel's van was quick and scenic. The picturesque Lamoille Valley, 15 miles long, 4 miles wide, began at the foot of the Ruby Mountains. Wheat, barley, and potato farms occupied the lowlands, though the fields were unplanted now, slumbering under scattered patches of snow. Between the valley floor and the mountains, the higher lands and foothills offered lush pasturage, and that was where the Jamesons had their ranch. At one time, they owned hundreds of acres on which they raised cattle, but eventually they sold off much of their property, which had risen substantially in value, and got out of the livestock business. Now, in their early 60s and retired, they owned about 50 acres in the foothills, employed no ranch hands, and kept only 3 horses and a few chickens. As Faye turned off the main valley road onto a lane leading into the highlands, she said,
"I think someone's following us."
The back doors of the van had no windows, so Ginger looked at the side-mounted mirror. A nondescript sedan was about 100 feet behind them.
"How do you know?" "Same car's been back there since the Union 76 in town." "Maybe it's coincidence," Ginger said.
When they had followed the lane over halfway up the valley wall, they reached the long, narrow driveway to the Jamesons' ranch, which led half a mile back through deep shadows thrown by flanking rows of big pinyons. Faye pulled into the driveway and slowed to see what the other car would do. Instead of going past, farther up into the hills, it pulled to a stop and parked along the outer lane, directly across from the entrance to the Jamesons' property. In the side-view mirror, Ginger could see that the car was a late-model Plymouth, painted a flat, ugly brown-green.
"Obviously a government heap," Faye said. "Pretty bold, aren't they?" "Well, if they've been eavesdropping on us, the way Jack says, through our own telephones, then they know we're onto them, so maybe they figure there's no point in playing coy with us."
Faye took her foot off the brake and headed up the driveway. Watching the unmarked Plymouth dwindle in the side mirror, Ginger said,
"Or maybe they're getting in position to take us into custody. Maybe they'd put tails on all of us. And maybe they're just waiting for the order to snatch us all at the same time."
On the narrow gravel driveway, the interlacing shadows of the overarching pinyons wove a darkness nearly as deep as night. As they drove up the two-lane road through the broad, snow-covered meadow toward the massive blast doors, Colonel Falkirk sat in the front passenger's seat of the Wagoneer, thinking about the catastrophe that would ensue from the revelation of Thunder Hill's secret. From a political perspective, this would make the Watergate mess look like a tea party. An unprecedented number of competing government institutions were involved in the cover-up, organizations that often operated in jealous opposition to one another. The FBI, CIA, National Security Agency, the United States Army, the Air Force, and others. It was a testament to the degree of potential danger that these groups could work together with nary a hitch and without a single leak in more than 18 months. But if the cover-up were uncovered, the scandal would extend throughout so much of the government that the faith of the American people in their leaders would be severely shaken. Of course, very few in any of those organizations knew what had happened. No more than 6 in the FBI, fewer in the CIA. Most of their men involved in the cover-up didn't know what they were covering up, which was why there had been no leaks. But the numero uno of each organization, the director of the FBI, the director of the CIA, the chief of staff of the Army, was completely in the know. Not to mention the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Secretary of State, and the President, his closest advisors, the Vice President. A lot of prominent men might fall from grace if this affair was not kept under lock and key. The political destruction wrought by the release of the secret would be only a small part of the devastation. The CISG, a think tank of physicists, biologists, anthropologists, sociologists, theologists, economists, educators, and other learned people, had pondered precisely this crisis at great length and depth years before it had arisen here in Nevada. The CISG had issued a 1,220-page top-secret report on its conclusions, a document that offered some disturbing reading. Leland knew that report by heart, for he was the military representative to the CISG and had helped write several position papers included in the final text. Within the CISG, the opinion was unanimous that the world would never be the same if such an event were to occur. All societies, all cultures, would be radically changed forever. Projected deaths over the first 2 years ranged in the millions. Lieutenant Horner, who was driving the Wagoneer, braked 20 feet in front of the giant blast doors that were set in the sudden, steep upper slope of the meadow. He didn't wait for the huge barriers to open, for he was not driving directly into Thunder Hill. Horner turned right into a small parking lot where 3 minibuses, 4 Jeep wagons, a Land Rover, and several other vehicles stood side by side. The twin blast doors, each 30 feet high and 20 feet wide, were so thick they could be opened only at a ponderous pace, producing a rumble that could be heard a mile away and felt in the air and in the ground at least half as far. When a truck, loaded with ammunition, weapons, or supplies, pulled up in front of the drive-in entrance, the doors required 5 minutes to roll apart. Opening those hangar-sized portals every time a lone man needed to walk in or out was unthinkably inefficient. So a second, man-sized door, nearly as formidable, was set in the hillside 30 feet to the right of the main entrance. There was no better vault than Thunder Hill in which to keep the secret of July 6th. It was an impregnable fortress. Leland and Lieutenant Horner hurried through the bitter air to the walk-in entrance, the small steel door, almost as blast-proof as the massive versions to the left, had an electronic lock that could be disengaged only by tapping the proper 4 numbers on a keyboard. The code changed every 2 weeks, and those entrusted with it were required to commit it to memory. Leland punched in the code, and the 14-inch thick lead core door slid aside with a sudden pneumatic whoosh. They stepped into a 12-foot-long concrete tunnel about 9 feet in diameter and brightly lit. It angled to the left. At the end was another door identical to the first, but it could not be opened until the outer door was closed. Leland touched a heat-sensitive switch just inside the tunnel entrance, and the outer door hissed shut behind him and Lieutenant Horner. Immediately, a pair of video cameras mounted on the ceiling at opposite ends of the chamber clicked on. The cameras tracked the two men as they walked to the inner door. No human eyes were watching the colonel and lieutenant on any video display, but the system was operated entirely by Vigilant, the security computer, as a precaution against the possibility that a traitor within Thunderhill's own guard unit might open the facility to hostile forces. Vigilant was not linked to the installation's main computer or to the outside world. Therefore, it was invulnerable to saboteurs seeking to take control of it by means of a modem or other electronic tap. The guard at the perimeter fence had notified Vigilant that Colonel Leland Falkirk and Lieutenant Thomas Horner would be arriving. Now, as they approached the inner door under the gazes of video cameras, the computer compared their appearance to stored holographic images of them, rapidly matching 42 points of facial resemblance. It was impossible to deceive Vigilant either with makeup or with a look-alike for an approved visitor. If Leland or Horner had been an imposter or unauthorized visitor, Vigilant would have sounded an alarm, simultaneously filling the entrance tunnel with a sedative gas. The lock on the inner door had no keyboard. No code would open it. Instead, a 1-foot-square panel of glass was set in the wall beside the door. Leland almost pressed his right hand palm down against the panel, hesitated, then used his left, and the glass lit and a faint humming arose. Vigilant scanned his palm print and fingerprints, comparing them to the prints in its files. Lieutenant Horner said, "Almost as hard to get in here as into heaven."
"Harder," Leland said.
The light behind the milky glass winked out, and Leland took his hand away. The inner door opened. They stepped into a huge, natural tunnel that had been improved by human hands. The domed rock overhead was lost in darkness because the lighting fixtures were suspended from black metal scaffolding, creating the illusion of a ceiling perhaps 20 or 30 feet below the true ceiling. The tunnel was 60 feet across and led into the mountain about 120 yards. In some places, the rock walls had natural contours, but in other places they carried the imprints of dynamite blasts and jackhammers and other tools that had been used to widen the narrow portions of the passageway. Incoming trucks could drive along the concrete floor to unloading bays beside immense cargo elevators that went down into deeper regions of the facility. A guard sat at a table beyond the door by which Leland and Horner entered. Considering the remoteness of Thunder Hill, the extent of sophisticated defenses, and the thoroughness with which Vigilant examined all visitors, a lone sentry seemed superfluous to Leland. Evidently, the sentry was of that same opinion, for he was not prepared for trouble. His revolver was holstered. He was eating a candy bar. Reluctantly, he looked up from an old novel by Jack Finney. He wore a coat because the open areas of the depository were never heated. Only the enclosed living quarters and work areas were kept warm. An enormous power supply was provided by a mini hydroelectric plant that harnessed an underground river, plus backup diesel generators. But there was not enough to warm the mammoth caverns. The subterranean temperature was a stable 55 degrees, quite bearable if one dressed for long work periods in the chilly air, as the guard had done. He saluted.
Colonel Falkirk, Lieutenant Horner, you're cleared to see Dr. Bunnell. You know how to find him, of course.
Of course, Falkirk said.
10 feet to the left, the burnished steel surface of the giant blast doors glimmered softly in the fluorescent light, looking rather like the sheer face of a great glacier. Leland and Lieutenant Horner turned right, away from the big doors, and walked deeper into the mountain toward the elevators. Thunderhill Depository was equipped with hydraulic lifts of 3 sizes, the largest of which rivaled the enormous elevators on aircraft carriers. A carrier's lifts were used to bring planes from the ship's hold onto the flight deck, and Thunderhill's also lowered and raised planes, among other things. In addition to $2.4 billion of equipment and materiel, freeze-dried food, medicine, portable field hospitals, clothing, blankets, tents, handguns, rifles, mortars, field artillery, ammunition, light military vehicles such as jeeps and armored personnel carriers, and 20 backpack nukes, the vast storage dump contained a variety of useful aircraft. First, the helicopters. 30 Sikorsky S-67 Black Hawk anti-tank gunships. 20 Bell King Cobras. 8 Anglo-French Westland Pumas, general-purpose transports, and 3 big medevac choppers. No conventional aircraft were stored at Thunder Hill, but there were 12 vertical takeoff jets of the type manufactured in England by Hawker Siddeley and known there as Harriers, but which were called AV-8As when in U.S. service. Because the Harriers were equipped with powerful vectored thrust engines, the craft could land and take off vertically, without need of a runway. In a grave crisis, for example, subsequent to a limited nuclear strike and a land invasion by enemy troops, the aircraft of Thunder Hill, both choppers and Harriers, could be lifted to the top level, rolled out through the massive blast doors, and sent hurtling into the sky. However, the current crisis did not involve war or require the unleashing of the depository's aircraft, so Leland and the lieutenant bypassed the 2 immense elevators. They also passed the 2 smaller but still oversized cargo elevators, their footsteps echoing off the stone walls, and took one of the 3 smallest cabs, about the size of a standard lift in a hotel, down into the bowels of Thunder Hill. Medical supplies, food, guns and all ammunition were stored on the 3rd level, the bottom floor of the complex, in a network of chambers which had been caulked, equipped with pressure release bores, and fitted with doors for the purpose of blast containment. On the 2nd, the middle level, All the vehicles and aircraft were kept in other huge caverns, and it was there, too, that the staff lived and worked. Leland and Lieutenant Horner got off the lift at the second level. They stepped into a lighted, circular, rock wall chamber 300 feet in diameter. It served as a hub. In fact, personnel called it the hub, from which four other caverns opened, and still more rooms lay beyond those four. The larger of those deep vaults contained, among other things, the aircraft, jeeps, and armored personnel carriers. There were no doors on three of the four caverns which led off the hub, for there was no serious danger of fire or explosion on that level. But the fourth chamber did, indeed, have doors, for it contained the secret of July 6th, which Leland and many others had conspired to conceal. He stopped now, a few steps out of the elevator, to study those portals, which were 26 feet high and 64 feet wide. They were made of cross-braced 2x4s, rather than steel, because they had been jerry-built to meet an emergency situation. There had been no time to order a fabricated metal door to close off the cavern. They reminded the colonel of the enormous wooden doors in the wall that had protected the frightened natives from the beast on the other half of their island in the original King Kong. Considering what lay behind these doors, that horror movie image did not inspire confidence. Leland shuddered. Lieutenant Horner said, "Still gives you the creeps, huh?"
"You mean you're comfortable with it now?"
"Hell no, sir. Hell no." Inset in the bottom of one of those huge wooden barriers was a much smaller, man-sized door through which researchers entered and exited the room beyond. An armed guard was positioned there to allow entrance only to those with the proper pass. The activities in that forbidden chamber had nothing to do with the other primary functions of the depository, and 90% of the personnel were not permitted access to the area. Indeed, 90% did not know what was in that cavern. Around the circumference of the hub, between the openings to other caverns, buildings had been erected along the walls and anchored to the rock. The structures dated to the first year of the depository's construction, back in the early 1960s. Then, they had served as offices for engineers, superintendents, and the Army's project officers. Over the years, an entire subterranean town had been erected in other caverns, sleeping quarters, cafeteria, recreation rooms, laboratories, machine shops, vehicle service center, computer rooms, even a PX, among other things. They were now occupied by the military and government personnel who were doing 1- and 2-year tours of duty at Thunder Hill. In the buildings, there was heat, better lighting, inside and outside telephone lines, kitchens, bathrooms, and all the myriad comforts of home. They were constructed of metal panels coated with baked blue or white or gray enamel, with only small windows and narrow metal doors. Though they had no wheels, they somewhat resembled motorhomes or house trailers drawn in a circle, as if they were the property of a modern-day encampment of gypsies who had found their way to this snug haven, 240 feet below the winter snows. Now, turning from the forbidden chamber with the wooden doors, Leland walked across the hub toward a white metal structure, Dr. Miles Bunnell's offices. Lieutenant Horner fell in dutifully at his side. The summer before last, Miles Bunnell, whom Leland Falkirk loathed, had moved into Thunder Hill to head all scientific inquiry into the events of that fateful July night. He had only been out of the depository on 3 occasions since then, never for longer than 2 weeks. He was obsessed with his assignment, or something worse than obsessed. 12 officers, enlisted men and civilians, were in sight within the hub, some crossing from one adjoining cavern to another, some just standing in conversation with one another. Leland looked them over as he passed them, unable to understand what kind of person would volunteer to work underground for weeks and months at a stretch. They were paid a 30% hardship bonus, but to Leland's way of thinking, that was inadequate compensation.
The depository was less oppressive than Schenkfield's small, windowless warrens, but not by much. Leland supposed he was slightly claustrophobic. Being underground made him feel as if he were buried alive. As an admitted masochist, he should have relished his discomfort, but this was one kind of pain he did not seek or enjoy. Dr. Miles Bunnell looked ill. Like nearly everyone in Thunder Hill, he was pasty-faced from being too long beyond the reach of sunlight. His curly black hair and beard only made his pallor more pronounced. In the fluorescent glare of his office, he looked almost like a ghost. He greeted Leland and Lieutenant Horner curtly, and he did not offer to shake hands with either of them. That suited the colonel fine. He was no friend of Bunnell's. A handshake would have been sheer hypocrisy. Besides, Leland was half afraid that Miles Bunnell had been compromised, that the scientist was no longer who or what he appeared to be, was no longer entirely human. And if that crazy, paranoid possibility was in fact true, he wanted no physical contact with Bunnell, not even a quick handshake. "Dr. Bunnell," Leland said coldly, using the hard tone of voice and icy demeanor that always elicited quaverous obedience, "your handling of this security breach has been either criminally inept, or you're the traitor we're looking for. Now hear me, loud and clear. This time, we're going to find the bastard who sent those Polaroid snapshots. No more broken lie detectors, no more botched interrogations, and we're going to find out if he's the one who teased Jack Twist into returning, and we're going to come down on him so hard he'll wish he'd been born a fly and spent his life in a stable sucking up horse shit." Utterly unruffled, Miles Bunnell smiled and said, "Colonel, that was the best Richard Jekyll impression I've ever seen, but entirely unnecessary. I'm as anxious as you to find the leak and plug it." Leland wanted to punch the son of a bitch. This was one reason he loathed Miles Bunnell. The bastard could not be intimidated. Calvin Charkle lived on O'Bannon Lane in a pleasant, middle-class, residential neighborhood in Evanston. Father Vikazik had to stop twice at service stations to ask directions. When he got to the corner of O'Bannon and Scott Avenue, only 2 blocks from Charkle's address, he was turned back by policemen manning an emergency barricade formed by 2 black-and-white cruisers and 1 paramedic van. There were also television crews running around with minicams. He also knew at once that the trouble on O'Bannon Lane was not merely coincidental. Something was happening at the Charkle house. In spite of temperatures in the mid-20s and wind gusting to 30 miles an hour, a crowd of about 100 had gathered outside the police barricade, on the sidewalks and on the lawns of the corner houses. Passing traffic on Scott Avenue was slowed by gawkers, and Stefan had to drive almost 2 blocks at a frustratingly slow pace before he found a parking space. When he walked back to the crowd and became part of it, seeking information from the well-bundled onlookers, Father Vikazik found that they were for the most part a friendly and strangely excited group, but creepy, too. Not blatantly weird, in fact, they were ordinary people, except for their totally insensitive fascination with the tragedy unfolding before them, as if it were as legitimate a source of thrills as a football game. It was definitely a tragedy, and one of a particularly horrible nature, which Father Vikazik discovered a minute after he joined the crowd and began to ask questions. A florid-faced, mustachioed man in a plaid hunting jacket and toboggan hat said, "Jesus, man, don't you watch the goddamn TV?" He was not the least restrained because he did not know he was talking to a priest. Stefan's topcoat and scarf concealed all evidence of his holy office. "Christ, fella, that's Charkle down there. Charkle the shark, man. That's what they're calling him. Guy's a dangerous loony. Been sealed up in his house there since yesterday, man. He shot him, 2 of his neighbors, and 1 cop already, and he's got him 2 goddamn hostages who, if you ask me, got about as much chance as a fucking cat at a Doberman convention."
Tuesday morning, via Pacific Southwest Airlines, Parker Fane flew into San Francisco from Orange County, then caught a connecting West Air flight to Monterey. It was an hour's trip up the California coast on PSA, a one-hour layover in San Francisco, and then only 35 minutes to Monterey. The journey seemed shorter because one of the other travelers, a pretty young woman, recognized his name, liked his paintings, and was in the mood to be enthralled by his burly charms. In Monterey, at the small airport rental agency, he hired a vomit-green Ford Tempo. It was an offense to his refined sense of color. The Tempo's tempo was satisfyingly allegro on flat roads, but a bit adagio on the hills. Nevertheless, it required less than half an hour to find the address Dom had given him for Gerald Salco, the man who had stayed at the Tranquility Motel with his wife and two daughters on the night of July 6th, and who had thus far been unreachable by both phone and Western Union. It was a big Southern colonial manor house, hideously out of place on the California coast, set on a prime half-acre in the shade of massive pines, with enough elaborately tended shrubbery to employ a gardener one full day a week, including beds of impatience that blazed with red and purple flowers even now, in January. Parker swung the Tempo into the majestic circular driveway and parked in front of broad, flower-bordered steps that led up to a deep, pillared veranda. In the shadows of the trees there was sufficient gloom to require lights indoors, but he saw none at the front windows. All of the drapes were tightly shut, and the house had a vacant look. He got out of the Tempo, hurried up the steps, and crossed the wide veranda, voicing his objection to the chilly air as he went. The area's usual morning fog had cleared from the airport, permitting landings, but it was still clinging to this part of the peninsula, bearding the pines, weaving tendrils between their trunks, muting the impatient's brilliant blooms. Winter in Northern California was a more bracing season than in Laguna Beach, and with the added damp chill of fog, it was not at all to Parker's taste. He had come dressed for it, however, in heavy corduroy slacks, a green plaid flannel shirt, a green pullover that mocked Izod Lacoste by featuring a goofy-looking appliqué armadillo on the breast instead of an alligator, and a three-quarter-length navy peacoat with sergeant stripes on one sleeve. Quite an outfit, especially when accented by day-glow orange running shoes. As he rang the doorbell, Parker looked down at himself and decided that maybe sometimes he dressed too eccentrically, even for an artist. He rang the doorbell six times, waiting half a minute between each ring, but no one came. Last night, when a man named Jack Twist had called him at 11 o'clock from a payphone in Elko, claiming to have a message from Dom, and had asked him to go to a specific payphone in Laguna for a callback in 20 minutes, Parker had still been working on a new and exciting painting that he had begun at 3 o'clock that afternoon. Nevertheless, deeply involved as he was with the work, he had hastened to the booth as directed, and he had agreed to the trip to Monterey without hesitation. The fact was that he had plunged into work as a means of taking his mind off Dom and the unfolding events in Elko County, for that was where he really wanted to be, neck deep in the mystery. When Twist told him about Dom's and the priest's psychic demonstration, floating salt and pepper shakers, levitating chairs, nothing short of World War III could have prevented Parker from going to Monterey. And now he was not going to be defeated by an empty house. Wherever the Salcos were, he would find them, and the best place to start was with the neighbors. Because of the half-acre lots and walls of intervening shrubbery, he could not easily walk next door. Back in the Tempo, as he put the car in gear, he glanced at the house again, and at first he thought he saw movement at one of the downstairs windows, a slightly parted drape falling back into place. He sat for a moment, staring, then decided the movement had been a trick of fog and shadows. He popped the handbrake and drove around the second half of the circular driveway out to the street, delighted to be playing spy again. Ernie and Dom parked the Jeep Cherokee at the end of the county road, and the pickup with the tinted windshield halted 200 yards behind them. Perched on its high, all-terrain tires, with goggle-eyed spotlights on its roof, it looked Dom thought, like a big insect poised alertly on the downsloping lane, ready to skitter toward a hidey-hole if it saw someone with a giant economy-sized can of Raid. The driver did not get out, nor did the passenger, if there was one. "Think there's going to be trouble here?" Dom asked, getting out of the Cherokee and joining Ernie at the side of the road.
"If they'd meant trouble, they'd already have made it," Ernie said. His breath steamed in the frigid air. "If they want to tag along and watch, that's all right by me. To hell with them."
They got two hunting rifles, a Winchester Model 94 carbine loaded with 32 special cartridges, and a .30-06 Springfield from the back of the Jeep Cherokee, handling the weapons conspicuously, in the hope that the men in the pickup would be encouraged to remain peaceable by the realization that their quarry could fight back. The mountains still rose on the western side of the lane, and forest still clothed those slopes. But the land that fell away to the east had become a broad, treeless field, the northern end of the series of meadows that lay along the valley wall. Although snow had not yet begun to fall, the wind was picking up. Dom was thankful for the winter clothes he had purchased in Reno, but he wished he had an insulated ski suit like Ernie was wearing, and a pair of those rugged lace-up boots instead of the flimsy zippered pair he now wore. Later today, Ginger and Faye would stop at a sporting goods store in Elko with a list of gear needed for tonight's operation, including suitable clothes for Dom and everyone else who did not already have them. At the moment, however, the insistent wind found entrance at Dom's coat collar and at the unelasticized cuffs of his sleeves. Leaving the Cherokee, he and Ernie went over the side of the road, down into the sloping meadow, continuing their inspection of the Thunderhill perimeter on foot. The high, electrified chain-link fence with the barbed wire overhang led out of the pines farther back. It ceased to parallel the northward course of the county road, turning east and down toward the valley floor. The snow in the meadow was 10 inches deep, but still below the tops of their boots. They slogged 200 yards to a point along the fence from which they could see in the distance the enormous steel blast doors set in the side of the valley wall. Dom saw no signs of human or canine guards. The snow on the other side of the fence was not marked by footprints or paw prints, which meant no one walked the perimeter on a regular schedule.
"A place like this, they're not going to be sloppy," Ernie said. "So if there aren't any foot patrols, there must be one hell of a lot of electronic security on the other side of this fence."
Dom had been glancing toward the top of the meadow, a little worried that the men in the all-terrain truck might be up to something with the Cherokee. This time, when he looked back, he saw a man in dark clothes, starkly silhouetted against the snow. The guy wasn't around the Cherokee and seemed to have no interest in it, but he had come down from the edge of the county road, descending a few yards into the inclined meadow. He was standing up there, unmoving, maybe 180 yards above Dom and Ernie, watching them. Ernie noticed the observer, too. He tucked his Winchester under his right arm and lifted the binoculars he had been carrying on a strap around his neck.
"He's Army. At least that looks like a regulation Army greatcoat he's wearing. Just watching us."
"You'd think they'd be more discreet."
"Can't follow anyone discreetly. Not in these wide-open spaces. Might as well be forthright. Besides, he wants us to see what he's carrying, so we'll know our rifles don't worry him."
"What do you mean? What's he carrying?"
"A Belgian FN submachine gun. Damn fine weapon. It can fire up to 600 rounds a minute."
If Father Vikazic had watched television news, he would have heard about Calvin Charkel last night, for the man had been a hot story for 24 hours. However, he had stopped watching TV news years ago, for he had decided that its relentless simplification of every story into stark black-and-white issues was intellectually corrupt, and that its gleeful concentration on violence, sex, gloom, and despair was morally repellent. He also might have read about the tragedy on O'Bannon Lane on the front pages of this morning's Tribune and Sun-Times, but he had left the rectory in such a hurry that he'd had no time for newspapers. Now, he pieced the story together from information provided by those in the crowd behind the police barricades. For months, Cal Sharkle had been acting
odd.
Ordinarily cheerful and pleasant, a bachelor who lived alone and was well-liked by everyone on O'Bannon Lane, he had become a brooder, doer, and even grim. He told neighbors he had a bad feeling about things and believed something important and terrible is going to happen. He read survivalist books and magazines and talked about Armageddon, and he was plagued by vivid nightmares. December 1st, he quit trucking, sold his rig, and told neighbors and relatives the end was imminent. He wanted to sell his house, buy remote property in the mountains, and build a retreat like those he had seen in the survivalist magazines.
"But there isn't time," he told his sister, Nan Gilchrist, "so I'll just prepare this house for siege."
He didn't know what was going to happen, did not understand the source of his own fear, though he said he was not concerned about nuclear war, Russian invasion, economic collapse, or anything else that alarmed most survivalists.
"I don't know what, but something strange and horrible is going to happen," he told his sister.
Mrs. Gilchrist made him see a doctor who found him fit, suffering only from job-related stress. But after Christmas, Calvin's previously garrulous nature gave way to a closed-mouth suspicion. During the first week of January, he had his phone disconnected, cryptically explaining,
"Who knows how they'll get at us when they come? Maybe they can do it over the phone."
He was unable or unwilling to identify they. No one considered Cal really dangerous. He had been a peaceful, kind-hearted man all his life. In spite of his new eccentric behavior, there was no reason to think he would turn violent. Then, yesterday morning at 8:30, Cal visited the Wilkersons, the family across the street with whom he had once been close, but from whom he had recently kept his distance. Edward Wilkerson told reporters that Cal said, "Listen, I can't be selfish about this. I'm all prepared, and here you are defenseless. So when they come for us, Ed, it'll be okay if you and your family hide out in my place." When Wilkerson asked who they were, Cal said, "Well, I don't know what they'll look like or what they'll call themselves, but they're going to do something bad to us. Maybe turn us into zombies." Cal Sharkle assured Wilkerson that he had plenty of guns and ammunition in his house and had taken steps to make a fortress of the place. Alarmed by talk of weapons and shootouts, Wilkerson had humored Cal, and as soon as the man left had called his sister. Nan Gilchrist had arrived at 10:30 with her husband and had told the worried Wilkerson that she would handle it, that she was sure she could persuade Cal to enter the hospital for observation. But after she and Mr. Gilchrist went into the house, Ed Wilkerson decided they might need some backup, so he and another neighbor, Frank Krelke, went to the Sharkle house to provide what assistance they could. Wilkerson expected Mr. or Mrs. Gilchrist to answer the bell, but Cal himself came to the door. He was distraught, nearly hysterical, and armed with a 20-gauge semi-automatic shotgun. He accused his neighbors of being zombies already.
"You've been changed!" he shouted at Wilkerson and Krelke. "Oh, God! I should have seen it! I should have known! When did it happen? When'd you stop being human? My God, now you've come to get us all in one swoop!"
Then, with a wail of terror, he opened fire with the shotgun. The first blast took Krelke in the throat at such close range that it decapitated him. Wilkerson ran, was hit in the legs as he reached the end of Sharkle's front walk, fell, rolled, and played dead, a ruse that saved his life. Now, Krelke was in the morgue, and Wilkerson was in the hospital, in good enough condition to talk to reporters. And Father Vikazic was at the entrance to O'Bannon Lane, where a young man in the crowd behind the police line was eager to fill in the last of it for him. The man's name was Roger Hasterwick, a temporarily unemployed beverage concoctionist, which Stefan suspected was an out-of-work bartender. He had a disturbing gleam in his eyes that might have been a sign of intoxication, drug use, lack of sleep, psychopathy, or all four. But his information was detailed and apparently accurate.
"So see, the cops close the block, evacuate the people out their houses, then they try to talk with this Sharkle the Shark, but he don't have a phone, see, and when they use a bullhorn, he won't answer him. The cops figure his sister and brother-in-law are in there alive, hostages, so nobody wants to do nothing rash."
"Wise," Father Vikazic said bleakly.
feeling even colder than the winter day in which she stood.
Wise, wise, wise,
Roger Hasterwick said impatiently, making it clear he preferred not to be interrupted.
So finally, with a half-hour daylight left, they decide they'll send in the SWAT guys to dig him out, maybe save his sister and brother-in-law. So they lob tear gas in there, see, and the SWAT guys rush the place, but when they get in, they hit trouble. Sharkle must have been working on the house for weeks, setting traps. The cops start falling over these thin wires he's strung everywhere, and one gets brained by a deadfall, which don't kill him, but sure does some damage. Then, Christ, Sharkle opens fire on him because he's wearing a gas mask same as they are and just waiting like a cat. The dude was prepared. So he blows one cop away utterly and wounds one. Then he heads down into the cellar and pulls the door shut and nobody can get in after him because there's not any regular cellar door but a steel door he's put in special. Not only that, but the outside cellar door around back is steel too. And what he's done is he's put heavy sheet metal shutters over the insides of the cellar windows. So it's your typical stalemate, see?
By Stefan's calculations, two people were dead, three wounded. Hasterwick said,
so the cops, they pulled in their horns real fast and figured to wait him out through the night. This morning, Sharkle the Shark slides open one of them sheet metal shutters on a basement window, see? And he shouts a bunch of stuff, really crazy stuff. And they figure something more is going to go down, but then he closes the shutter again, and since then, nothing. I sure hope he does something soon, because it's cold, and I'm beginning to get bored.
What did he shout? Stefan asked.
Huh?
This morning, what crazy stuff did he yell from the basement?
Ah. Well, see, what he says...
Roger Hasterwick stopped when he realized that a piece of news passing in from the edge of the crowd had electrified everyone. People hurried away from the barricade, some walking fast and some running south on Scott Avenue. Appalled by the prospect of missing new bloodshed, Hasterwick grabbed frantically at a blotchy-faced man in a deerstalker cap, the flaps of which were down but flapping loose.
What's happening?
Trying to pull away from Hasterwick, the man in the deerstalker cap said,
guy down here is a van with his own police band radio. He's tuning in on the cops, the SWAT team. They're getting ready to wipe that fucking Sharkle off the map.
He wrenched loose of Hasterwick and rushed away, and Hasterwick hurried after him. Father Vikosik stared after the departing throng for a moment. Then he glanced around at the 10 or 12 onlookers who had remained, at the officers manning the barricade, past the barricade. More death. Murder. He could sense it coming. He should do something to stop it. But he could not think. He was numb with dread. Until now, he had seen, and been able to see, only a positive side to the unfolding mystery. The miraculous cures and other phenomena had engendered only joy and an expectation of divine revelations to come, but now he was seeing the dark side of the mystery, and he was badly shaken by it. Finally, hoping he would not be mistaken for just another ghoul in the bloodthirsty crowd, Stefan hurried after Roger Hasterwick and the others. They had gathered almost a block south of O'Bannon Lane, around a recreational van, a metallic blue Chevrolet with a California beach mural on the side. The owner, a huge and hugely bearded man sitting behind the wheel, had opened both doors and turned up the volume on the police band radio so everyone could hear the cops in action. In a minute or two, the essentials of their attack plan were clear. The SWAT team was already moving into place, back into the first floor of Sharkle's house. They would use a small, precisely shaped charge of plastic explosives to blow the steel cellar door off its pins, not enough to send shrapnel cutting through the basement. Simultaneously, another group of officers would blow off the exterior cellar door with a similar, carefully gauged charge. Even as the smoke was clearing, the two groups would storm into the basement and catch Cal Sharkle in a pincer attack. That strategy was terribly dangerous for the officers and the hostages, though the authorities had decided that they would be in far greater danger if action was delayed any further. Listening to the radio relayed voices crackle in the cold January air, Father Vikosik suddenly knew he must stop the attack. If it was carried out, the slaughter would be worse than anyone imagined. He had to be allowed to go past the barricade, to the house, and talk to Cal Sharkle. Now. Right away. Now.
He turned from the Chevy van and raced back toward the entrance to O'Bannon Lane, a block away. He was not sure what he would say to Sharkle to get through his paranoia. Perhaps, "You are not alone, Calvin." He'd think of something. His abrupt departure from the van apparently gave the crowd the idea that he had heard or seen something happening up at the barricade. He was less than halfway back to the entrance to O'Bannon Lane when younger and fleeter onlookers began to pass him, shouting excitedly, plunging off the sidewalk and out into the street, bringing a complete halt to the already crawling traffic on Scott Avenue. Brakes barked, horns blew. There was the thud of one bumper hitting another. Stefan was jostled by runners and struck so hard that he fell to his hands and knees on the pavement. No one stopped to help him. Stefan got up and ran on. The air seemed to have thickened with animal madness and bloodlust. Stefan was horrified at the behavior of his fellow men, and his heart was pounding, and he thought, "This is what it might be like in hell, running forever in the midst of a frantic and gibbering mob." By the time Stefan reached the police blockade, more than half the frenzied crowd had returned ahead of him. They were jammed against the sawhorses and police cars, craning to see into the forbidden block of O'Bannon Lane. He pushed in among them, desperate to get to the head of the mob so he could speak to the police. He was pushed, shoved, but he shoved back, telling them he was a priest, but no one was listening. And he felt his fedora knocked off his head, but he persisted, and then at last he was through to the front of the surging multitudes. The policeman angrily ordered the mob to move back, threatened arrest, drew batons, lowered the visors on their riot helmets. Father Vikazic was prepared to lie, to tell the police anything that might get them to postpone the imminent attack on the house, tell them that he was not just a priest but Sharkle's own priest, that he knew what was wrong, knew how to get Sharkle to surrender. Of course, he didn't really know how to obtain Sharkle's surrender, but if he could buy time and talk to Sharkle, he might think of something. He caught the attention of an officer who ordered him to step back. He identified himself as a priest. The cop wasn't listening, so Stefan tore open his topcoat and pulled off his white scarf to reveal his Roman collar. "I'm a priest!" But the crowd surged forward, pushing Stefan against a sawhorse, and the barrier fell over and the cop shoved back angrily, in no mood to listen. An instant later, two small explosions shook the air, one a split second after the other, low and flat, but hard. The hundred voices of the crowd gasped as one, and everybody froze, for they knew what they had heard, the SWAT team blowing the steel doors off the cellar. A third explosion followed the first two, an immense and devastating blast that shook the pavement, that hurt the ears, that vibrated in bones and teeth, that shot slabs and splinters of Sharkle's house into the wintry sky, that seemed to shatter the day itself and cast it down in a billion broken pieces. Again, with a single voice, the crowd cried out. Instead of pressing toward the blockade, this time they scrambled back in fear, suddenly realizing that death could be not just an interesting spectator sport, but a participatory activity. "He had a bomb," one of the barricade cops said. My God, Sharkle had a bomb in there." He turned to the emergency medical van in which two paramedics were waiting and he shouted, Go! The red beacons flashed atop the paramedic's wagon. It pulled out of the barricade, speeding toward the middle of the block. Shaking with horror, Father Vikasic tried to follow on foot, but one of the cops grabbed him and said, "Hey, get the hell back there. I'm a priest. Someone may need comforting last rites. Father, I wouldn't care if you were the Pope himself. We don't know for sure that Sharkle's dead." Numbly, Father Vikazic obeyed, though the tremendous power of the explosion left no doubt in his mind that Cal Sharkle was dead. Sharkle and his sister, and his brother-in-law, and most members of the SWAT team. How many altogether? Maybe 5? 6? 10? Moving aimlessly back through the crowd, absent-mindedly tucking his scarf in place, and buttoning his coat, partially in a state of shock, murmuring a Pater Noster, he saw Roger Hasterwick, the unemployed bartender with the queerly gleaming eyes. He put a hand on Hasterwick's shoulder and said, "What did he shout to the police this morning?" Hasterwick blinked. "Huh? What?" "Before we got separated, you told me Calvin Sharkle slid open the metal shutter on one of the cellar windows and shouted a lot of weird stuff this morning, and you thought something was going to happen, but then nothing did. What exactly did he say?
Hasterwick's face brightened with the memory.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was real weird, see? Straight out crazy stuff.
He scrunched up his face, striving to recall the madman's exact words. When he had them, he grinned, rolled his mouth as if savoring the revelation, then repeated Sharkle's ravings for Stefan's enjoyment. Stefan not only failed to enjoy the performance, but second by dreadful second, he became increasingly convinced that Calvin Sharkle had not been insane.
Confused, yes.
Baffled and afraid because of the tremendous stress generated by his brainwashing and by the collapse of his memory blocks, badly confused, but not insane. Roger Hasterwick and everyone else thought Sharkle's shouted accusations and declarations and imprecations flung at the world through the shielded window of a jerry-built fortress were obviously the lunatic fantasies of a demented mind. But Father Vikazik had an advantage over everyone else. He saw Sharkle's statements in the context of events at the Tranquility Motel, in the context of miracle cures and telekinetic phenomena, and he wondered if there might be some truth in the claims and accusations that the poor frightened man had shouted through the basement window. And wondering, he felt the fine hairs rise on the back of his neck. He shivered. Seeing that reaction, Hasterwick said,
"Hey, ain't no point taking it serious, for Christ's sake. You don't think what he said was true. Hell, the guy was a nut. He blowed himself up, didn't he?"
Father Vikazik ran north along Scott Avenue to the parish car. Even before he had arrived in Evanston and discovered the unfolding tragedy at Calvin Sharkle's house, Stefan Vikazik had half expected to be on a flight to Nevada before the day was through. The events at the Mendoza's apartment and at the Halberg's place had set a fire of wonder and curiosity burning in him, and the blaze would not be quenched unless he plunged into the activities of the troubled group in Elko County. Now, because of what he had just learned from Hasterwick, the urge to go to Nevada had become a burning need. If only half of what Sharkle had shouted through the basement window was true, Stefan had to go to Nevada, not only to witness a miracle, but to do what he could to protect those who had gathered at the Tranquility. All his life, he had been a rescuer of troubled priests, a shepherd bringing lost souls back into the fold. This time, however, he might be called upon to save minds and lives as well. The threat of which Calvin Sharkle had spoken was one that might put body and brain in as much jeopardy as the spirit. He slipped the car in gear again. He drove out of Evanston. He decided not to return to the rectory to pack. There was no time. He would head straight to O'Hare International Airport and take the first available seat on the first available flight west. Dear God, he thought, what have you sent us? Is it the greatest gift for which we could have asked? Or a plague, to make all biblical plagues pale by comparison? Father Stefan Vikazik put the pedal to the metal and drove south and then west toward O'Hare like, well, like a bat out of hell.
Ginger and Faye spent the larger part of the morning with Elroy and Nancy Jameson, under the pretense that Ginger, supposedly the daughter of an old friend of Faye's, was moving west for unspecified health reasons and was interested in learning about Elko County. The Jamesons were local history buffs, eager to talk about the county, especially about the beauty of the Lamoille Valley. Actually, indirectly and directly, Ginger and Faye were seeking indications that Elroy and Nancy were suffering from the effects of collapsing memory blocks. They found none. The Jamesons were happy, untroubled. Their brainwashing had been as successful as Faye's. Their false memories were firmly rooted. Bringing them into the Tranquility family would put them in jeopardy while serving no great purpose. In the motel van, as they pulled away from the Jameson house, with Elroy and Nancy waving from the front porch, Ginger said,
"Good people. Really nice people." "Yes," Faye said, "reliable. Wish they were standing beside us in this thing. On the other hand, I'm happy they're well out of it."
Both women were quiet then, and Ginger figured Faye's thoughts were the same as her own. They were wondering if the government car was still parked along the county road near the entrance to the Jamesons' place, and if the men in it would still be content merely to follow them. Ernie and Dom had armed themselves for their expedition into the mountains around Thunderhill Depository. However, considering the unprovocative nature of Faye's and Ginger's errands, no one had thought that they might be in special danger, too. Ginger, like many attractive women living alone in a city, knew how to use a handgun, and Faye, a good marine wife, was something of an expert, but their knowledge and expertise was of no use when they were not armed. Having driven only a quarter mile along the Jamesons' half-mile driveway, Faye stopped the van in one of the deepest pools of shadows cast by the overhanging pinyons.
"I'm probably being melodramatic," she said.
She slipped open a few buttons on her coat and reached under her sweater.
"And these won't be much good if they point guns at our heads."
Grimacing, she withdrew two steak knives and put them on the seat between her and Ginger. Surprised, Ginger said,
"Where'd you get these?"
"This is why I insisted on drying the breakfast dishes while Nancy washed them. Putting away the silverware, I swiped these. Didn't want to ask straight out for a weapon. That would have meant bringing Nancy and Elroy into it, which it was clear we weren't going to have to do. I can return them later when this is over."
She picked up one of the knives.
"The end's nicely pointed, the blade sharp and serrated." "Like I said, not much help if they've got a gun at your head. But if they were to run us off the road and try to force us into their car, you keep the knife a secret until you get your opening, then stab the bastard."
"Got it,"
Ginger said. She grinned and shook her head.
"Someday I hope you'll get a chance to meet Rita Hannaby."
"Your friend in Boston?"
"Yes. You and Rita are a lot alike, I think."
"Me and a high society lady?"
Faye said doubtfully.
"Can't imagine what we'd have in common."
"Well, for one thing, you both have such equanimity, such serenity, regardless of what's happening."
Putting the knife back on the seat, Faye said,
"Oh, when you're a service wife, you either learn to go with the flow, or you go crazy.
And both you and Rita look so feminine, soft and dependent on the outside, but inside, each of you is, in your own way, tough as nails."
Faye smiled.
"Honey, you got a bit of that yourself."
They drove the last quarter mile of the pinyon-shaded driveway, out of the shadows and into the midday gloom of the pending storm. The brown-green, stripped-down government car was still parked along the county road. Two men were in it. They looked impassively at Ginger. Impulsively, she waved at them. They did not wave back. Faye drove down toward the floor of the Lamoille Valley. The car followed. Miles Bunnell slumped in the big chair behind his gray metal desk and looked bored, and Miles Bunnell ambled around his office while answering questions in a tone of voice that was sometimes indifferent and sometimes amusedly ironic. But Miles Bunnell never fidgeted, groveled, looked frightened, or became angry, as almost any other man would have done in the same situation. Colonel Leland Falkirk hated him. Sitting at a scarred table in one corner of the room, Leland worked slowly through a stack of personnel files, one for each of the civilian scientists who were conducting studies and experiments in the cavern with the immense wooden doors, where the secret of July 6th was contained. He was hoping to narrow the field of possible traitors by determining which men and women could have been in New York City during the time the two notes and Polaroid snapshots had been mailed to Dominic Corbasis in Laguna Beach. He had told Thunder Hill's military security staff to do this work on Sunday, and they professed to have completed the inquiries and to have found nothing to pinpoint the leak. But in light of the screw-ups in their investigation thus far, including two sabotage lie detectors, he no longer trusted them any more than he trusted Bunnell or the other scientists. He had to do it himself. But right away, Leland ran into problems. For one thing, during the past 18 months, too damn many civilians have been brought into the conspiracy. 37 men and women, representing a broad spectrum of scientific disciplines, had possessed both high security clearances and specialized knowledge essential to the research program Bunnell had devised. 38 civilians, counting Bunnell. It was a miracle that 38 eggheads, utterly lacking in military discipline, could have kept any secret so long, let alone this one. Worse, only Bunnell and seven others were engaged in the research full-time, to the exclusion of all other professional pursuits, and to the extent that they actually lived in Thunder Hill. The other 30 had families and university positions they could not leave for long periods of time, so they came and went as their schedules permitted, sometimes staying a few days, maybe a few weeks, rarely as long as a few months. Therefore, it would be a long and arduous job to investigate each and determine if and when he or she had been in New York. Worse still, of the 8 members of the full-time investigatory team, 3 had been in New York in December, including Dr. Miles Bunnell himself. In short, the list of suspects currently numbered at least 33 among the scientific research staff alone. Leland was also suspicious of the entire depository security staff, though Major Fugata and Lieutenant Helms, the head of security and his right-hand man, were supposedly the only security personnel who knew what was happening in the Forbidden Cavern. On Sunday, soon after Fugata began questioning the full-time research staff and those part-time researchers currently in residence, he discovered that the polygraph was damaged and could not produce reliable results. Yesterday, when a new machine was sent up from Schenckfield, it also proved defective. Fugata said that the second machine was already damaged when it arrived from Schenckfield, but that was bullshit. Someone involved in the project had seen reports that the witness's memory blocks were breaking down. Deciding to exploit that opportunity, he egged some of them along with cryptic notes and Polaroids stolen from the files. The bastard had nearly gotten away with it, and now that the heat was coming down on him, he had sabotaged the lie detectors. Pausing in his perusal of the personnel files, Leland looked at Miles Bunnell, who was standing in the small window.
"Doctor, give me the benefit of your insight into the scientific mind."
Turning away from the window, Bunnell said,
"Certainly, Colonel. Everyone working with you knows about the classified CISG report that was done 7 years ago. They know the terrible consequences that might result if we went public with our discoveries. So why would any of them be so irresponsible as to undermine project security?"
Dr. Bunnell assumed a tone of earnest helpfulness, but Leland heard the acid-sharp disdain beneath the surface.
"Some disagree with CISG's conclusions. Some think going public with these discoveries wouldn't result in a catastrophe, that the CISG was fundamentally wrong, too elitist in its viewpoint."
"Well, I believe the CISG was correct. And you, Lieutenant Horner?"
Horner was sitting near the door.
"I agree with you, Colonel. If the news is broken to the public, they'll have to be prepared slowly, over maybe 10 years. And even then..."
Leland nodded. To Bunnell, he said,
"I have a low but realistic opinion of my fellow men, Doctor, and I know how poorly most would cope with the new world that would follow the release of these discoveries. Chaos, political and social upheaval, just like the CISG report said."
Bunnell shrugged.
"You're entitled to your view."
But his tone said, "Even if your view is ignorant and arrogant and narrow-minded." Leaning forward in his chair, Leland said,
"How about you, Doctor? Do you believe the CISG was right?"
Evasively, Bunnell said,
"I'm not your man, Colonel. I didn't send those notes and Polaroids to Corvaces and the Blocks." "Okay, Doctor. Then will you support my effort to have everyone in the project interrogated with the assistance of drugs? Even if we get the polygraph fixed, the answers we obtain will be less reliable than those we'd get with sodium pentothal and certain other substances."
Bunnell frowned.
"Well, there are some who'd object strenuously. These are people of superior intellect, Colonel. Intellectual life is their primary life, and they won't risk subjecting themselves to drugs that might, as a side effect,
have even the slightest permanent detrimental effect on their mental function. These drugs don't have that effect. They're safe.
They're safe most of the time, maybe. But some of my people will have moral objections to using drugs for any reasons, even safe drugs, even for a worthwhile purpose.
Doctor, I'm going to push for drug-assisted interrogation of everyone in Thunder Hill, those who know the secret and those who don't. I'm going to demand General Alvarado approve. Alvarado was commanding officer of the Thunder Hill Depository, a pencil-pushing desk jockey who had spent his career on his backside. Leland liked Alvarado no more than he liked Bunnell. If the general approves drug-assisted interrogation, and if any of your people refuse, I'll come down hard on them, hard enough to break them. That includes you, if you refuse. You understand me?
Oh, perfectly, Bunnell said, still unruffled.
Disgusted, the colonel pushed the remaining personnel files aside.
This is too damn slow. I need the traitor quickly, not a month from now. We'd better repair the polygraph.
He started to get up, then sat down as if he'd just thought of what he was about to ask, though it had been on his mind since he entered the depository.
Doctor, what do you think of this development with Cronin and Corvasis, these miraculous cures, the other bizarre phenomenon? What do you make of it?
Finally, Bunnell showed strong, genuine emotion. He unfolded his hands from behind his head and leaned forward in his chair. I'm sure it scares the hell out of you, Colonel. But there could be another, less cataclysmic explanation than the one on which you've fixated. Fear is your only reaction. While I think it might be the greatest moment in the history of the human race. But whatever the case, we've absolutely got to talk with Cronin and Corvasis. Tell them everything and seek their cooperation to discover exactly how they obtained these wonderful powers. We can't simply eliminate them or put them through another memory wipe without knowing all the answers.
If we bring everyone at the Tranquility into this, tell them the secret and then don't wipe their memories again, the cover-up can't be maintained.
Possibly not, Bunnell said. And if that's the case, then the public will just have to be told.
Damn it, Colonel! Because of these recent developments, studying Cronin and Corvasis takes precedence over everything else, including the cover-up. Not only studying them, but letting them have a chance to develop whatever strange talents they may have. In fact, when will you take them into custody?
This afternoon, at the latest.
Then we can expect you to bring them to us sometime tonight?
Yes.
Leland rose from his chair again. He picked up his coat and walked to the office door, where Lieutenant Horner was waiting. He paused.
Doctor, how will you know if Cronin and Corvasis are changed or not? You think there's no real chance of possession. But if you're wrong, if they're not entirely human anymore, and if they don't want you to know the truth, how would you possibly discover it? Obviously, they could defeat a lie detector or any truth serums we have.
That's a puzzler, all right. Miles Bunnell stood up, jammed his hands into the pockets of his lab coat, and began to pace energetically.
My God, it's a real challenge, isn't it?
We've been working on the problem ever since we learned about their new powers from you on Sunday. We've been through ups and downs, despair, but now we think we can deal with it. We've devised medical tests, psychological tests, some tricky damn stuff, and we think that all of it taken together will accurately determine whether or not they're infected, whether or not they're human anymore. I think your fears are utterly unfounded. We thought infection, possession, was a danger at first, but it's been more than a year since we learned we were wrong. I think they can be entirely human and still have these powers. Are entirely human.
I don't agree. My fears are well-founded. And if Corvasis and Cronin and the others have changed, and if you believe you can get the truth out of them, you're kidding yourself. If they've changed, they're so superior to you that deceiving you would be child's play. You haven't even heard what we've...
And something else, Doctor. Something you haven't thought of, but which I must consider. Maybe this will help you appreciate my position, with which you've thus far had little sympathy. Don't you realize I have to be suspicious and scared of more than just the people at the Tranquility? Ever since we've learned of these recent developments, these paranormal powers, I've been scared of you as well.
Bennell was thunderstruck.
Me? You've been working here with it, Doctor. You're in that cavern nearly every day, doing lab work every day, probing, testing every damn day for 18 months, with only 3 brief vacations. If Corvaces and Cronin were changed in a few hours of contact, why shouldn't I suspect you've been changed after 18 months?
For a moment, Bennell was too shocked to speak. Then he said, "But this isn't the same at all. My studies here were after the fact. I'm essentially a fire marshal, a guy who came in after the blaze to sift through the ashes and figure out what happened. The potential for possession or infection, if it ever existed, was at the beginning, in the first hours, not later."
"How can I be sure of that?" Leland asked, staring at him coldly.
"But under these lab conditions, with safety precautions..."
"We're dealing with the unknown, Doctor. We can't foresee every problem that might arise. That's the very nature of the unknown. And you can't take precautions against something you can't foresee."
Bennell shook his head violently in denial of the very possibility. "No. No, no. Oh, no."
"If you think I'm exaggerating my concern just to irritate you," Leland said, "then you might ask yourself why Lieutenant Horner sat in that chair so alertly during our long conversation. After all, as you know, he's an expert in polygraphs, and he could have gone and repaired yours while you and I talked. But I didn't want to be in a room with you alone, Dr. Bennell. Not alone. No way."
Blinking, Bennell said, "You mean because I might have somehow..."
Leland nodded. "Because if you have been changed, then you might have been able to change me, too, by some process I can't even begin to imagine. Alone, you might have used the opportunity to attack me, infect me, arrange for me to be possessed, pour the human spirit out of me and pour something else in." Leland shuddered. "Hell, I don't know how to put it best, but we both know what I mean."
"We even wondered if 2 of us were enough to ensure our safety," Lieutenant Horner said, his voice rumbling through the low-ceilinged room and vibrating vaguely in the metal walls. "I kept a close eye on you, Doctor. You didn't notice my hand was always near my revolver." Bennell was too astonished to speak. Leland said,
"Doctor, you may think I'm a suspicious bastard who's too quick on the trigger, an unregenerate xenophobic fascist, but I've been put in charge of this not merely to keep the truth from the public, but also to protect